Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hi, Namulanta Kombo here with some very exciting news. Dear Daughter is back for a new series. I'm putting together a handbook to life for daughters everywhere, full of stories and advice to help navigate life. That's Dear Daughter from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 14 hours GMT on Saturday the 23rd of March, these are our main stories. At least 115 people are now known to have died in an attack on a concert hall near Moscow. President Putin says the attackers were arrested heading for Ukraine. During a visit to the Egypt-Gaza border, the UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres makes a renewed and impassioned call for an immediate ceasefire. Also in this podcast, we head to Bolivia, where people are urged to go into lockdown, but not because of a COVID outbreak. Just before we recorded this podcast, President Putin gave a TV address responding to the concert hall attack on Friday, in which at least 115 people were killed.
All those who were shooting and killing people were found and detained. They tried to hide and were moving towards Ukraine, where, according to preliminary information for them from the Ukrainian side, a window to cross the border had been prepared. Altogether, 11 people were detained.
Mr. Putin said there would be a national day of mourning on Sunday to commemorate the people who died in Moscow's Crocus City Hall. The Islamic State group said it was behind the attack. Our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, is outside the concert hall.
The mood is very somber here, I have to say. All morning, people have been bringing flowers, laying flowers at a makeshift shrine, standing, trying to comprehend the scale of this attack that has claimed so many lives. And that 115 figure, that is not the final death toll. It's expected to be higher than that. Some people who've come here today told me that they found out what happened on the news and felt they had to come. But I spoke to one woman who was here last night at the rock concert and managed to escape and survived. She told me it was hard to find the words to describe what she went through. She said that all day today she was replaying in her eyes and in her ears the nightmare that she went through. The FSB, Russia's Domestic Security Service, says it has arrested 11 people, including four gunmen. It has claimed that the gunmen plan to cross the border into Ukraine. Now, that FSB statement, put together with what pro-Kremlin commentators have been saying, suggests to me that Moscow is keen to point the finger at Kyiv, even though Ukraine says it had nothing to do with this attack and the Islamic State has already claimed responsibility for it.
Steve Rosenberg. Sergei Markov is a former member of parliament for Vladimir Putin's United Russia Party and a supporter of the president. Julian Warraker asked him for his reaction to the attack.
I visited this Crocus City Hall many times, and it was a great, very, very big trade center, one of the biggest in Russia, in Europe, I think. And also I visited a few times this concert hall, and of course this very big tragedy. Frankly speaking, in Russia, here, absolute majority of the people strongly believe that this terrorist attack had been organized by Ukrainian regime. And also some rumors and information from American intelligence service saying it's Islamic State, but it's very difficult to believe in this version.
Well, let me just go there for a moment, if I may, because the Islamic State group has claimed it carried out the attack, but you're saying that Well, that's what they've claimed.
No, it's wrong information.
Okay.
This was fake news organized from the resources close to the Ukraine, that Islamic State claim that they take responsibility. No, and the official resources, they said. But this also old formula had been used by Islamic State, you know, a few years ago, had been used for this fake news.
Right. So, well, just so that I can be clear,
take any responsibility.
Indeed. Just so that I can be clear with people listening to the conversation, Ukraine has denied any involvement. And I should also add that the US says that there is no reason to doubt that Islamic State claim, because it says it warned Russia of a potential attack on, quote, large gatherings in Moscow earlier this month. That is true, is it not?
We know that Islamic radicals didn't attack Russia during many years. Also, you should know the culture. For Muslims, it's Ramadan. It's holy month right now. And to organize terrorist attack during the holy month, and specifically it was Friday, but Friday is holy day for Muslims. They are praying exactly those time. To imagine that people who believe that they are radical Muslims and they sharply violated the rules of holy month Ramadan and holy Friday is difficult to imagine.
It seems the assumption from the Kremlin, at least, is that Ukraine was behind the attacks. But our security correspondent Gordon Carrera says that position is hard to defend.
So far, the claim from IS that they were behind it is impossible to independently verify. The US, though, say they've got no reason to doubt it. And it does look as if they had some kind of intelligence about a possible attack linked to IS. In recent weeks, back on March 7th, the US issued a warning. So I think a lot of signs point in that direction. The other reason would be the nature of the attack, this kind of marauding gunman targeting as many civilians as possible, that is a signature, if you like, of the way that group IS operates. We saw something very similar, for instance, at a concert venue in Paris in November 2015 at the Bataclan. So that is much more typical of a kind of IS operation. Now, it is true, of course, Ukraine has operated inside Russia. It's had small groups carry out attacks. It's even carried out a targeted bombing against an individual, it's thought, in Moscow. But not this kind of wide-scale, indiscriminate attacks against civilians. And so that wouldn't make sense in terms of past behaviour. So I think all those signs do point towards ISIS, even though we can't at this stage be absolutely sure about that.
And the indication from Sergei Markov there that a lot of people in Russia feel that Ukraine was behind it, perhaps a predictable reaction.
Yes, and I think you could sense almost immediately after the attack took place that the context of Ukraine was going to be important in this, because you had senior Russian officials saying, if this is Ukraine, the retribution would be terrible. You had some people in Ukraine, first of all, suggesting, well, this could be a provocation by Russia to justify further attacks on Ukraine. And then you had the Ukrainians deny it very strongly from a presidential advisor, and you had Washington, Ukraine's ally, say there's no indication that Ukraine was involved. So clearly there was concern that this could play into that Ukraine conflict.
Either way, there is likely to be, well, certainly in the short term, security measures will be upped around Moscow and around the country. One imagines in the medium term as well, things may well change there.
Yes, in the short term, certainly there's increased security at sensitive sites, at railway stations, airports. Mass gatherings have been cancelled over the weekend. And yes, you would expect Russia to be on a much higher alert about this. It is true, though, they have had waves of such attacks in the past, targeting things like the Moscow Metro. We've seen Russian airliners blown up by bombs back in 2015 and other incidents in the past, if you go back to Chechnya in the early 2000s, including sieges at theatres. So Russia, unfortunately, does have a history of having been targeted in this way, but I think the nature of this will come as a shock to a lot of people and lead to major questions about security, how it could have happened, and that question about whether there were some kind of warnings potentially from the US and if they were acted on.
Gordon Carrera. And later in the podcast, we'll look more closely at the likelihood of Islamist involvement in the attack with our specialist from the BBC's monitoring service. Some other news now. The revelation that the Princess of Wales is currently undergoing treatment for cancer has prompted widespread sympathy from around the world. She made the announcement in a video shared on social media. Speaking directly to the camera, she said her priority was protecting her children.
Having William by my side is a great source of comfort and reassurance too, as is the love, support and kindness that has been shown by so many of you. It means so much to us both. We hope that you'll understand that as a family, we now need some time, space and privacy while I complete my treatment.
The announcement comes after weeks of social media speculation about the princess's health. The BBC's Martha Carney has been speaking to David Yelland, former editor of the Sun newspaper here in the UK, and first to the former communications secretary to Queen Elizabeth, Simon Lewis.
He was so powerful, so brave, so dignified. I cannot think of another occasion where a member of the royal family has spoken directly about their health in that way. It's unprecedented. It was just a magnificent piece of communications, if I can put it that way.
And also the way that she was talking, David, about the need to protect her children, and bad enough to have to tell your children that anyway, but knowing that how quickly it's going to go round the world in terms of publicity must be an added pressure.
I think it was an act of huge personal courage. The fact that it was shot on Wednesday by a BBC Studios team and didn't appear until Friday night shows that the palace have perhaps learnt that trusting a third party is the way to go with these communications. They didn't film it on an iPhone. There's not a single person in a conspiracy theory-filled social media world that doesn't think this is totally authentic.
And was it because of all that speculation, Simon, that she had to go public with this message, something that you'd imagine certainly for previous generations, for most people around the country, they'd be able to keep quiet?
Let's be honest, there has been a frenzy over the last few weeks, and I do think there are lessons to be learned. I mean, the social media world, even the photograph that they produced, that, you know, perhaps that was because they felt they had to do something. I think the lesson to be learned is still about privacy and the privacy of people, particularly people in prominent public positions, not ever having to be forced, I think, to do things they don't want to do, because no one ever knows the full picture in a family circumstance.
I imagine quite a few people may be feeling rather guilty about what they were up to.
I think so, but I also think it's important for the powers to understand, and I think they do understand, that this is not a 20th century problem. The newspapers in this country, including people like Victoria Newton, who's the editor of The Sun and The Mail, have been totally supportive. There has been no invasion of privacy from newspapers in the way that affected Princess Diana. The problem is social media. And the problem that they have experienced is that a vacuum of months went by and it was filled by social media. And although it may seem perhaps just a tiny bit controversial to say, we're now in March. If we go forward 6-9 months, that vacuum will open up again and social media will very quickly come in again. So we will need to be updated in some way, maybe something in the summer, something at Christmas. There's obviously the Christmas message. It doesn't have to be Kate, it could be William. They're in the vanguard. I think what the communications team at the palace are having to deal with at the moment, the White House team will be watching. Well, I know they are, because, you know, how do they update on Biden's health and so on? Not that he has cancer, but you know what I mean. How do you do this? It's a whole new world.
That was the former editor of the British Sun newspaper, David Yelland, and Queen Elizabeth's former communications secretary, Simon Lewis. Coming up in the podcast.
Some people think my music is dope. Some people see me as like this satanic devil. My sexuality was just like the elephant in the room.
A new documentary on the controversial rapper Lil Nas X.
Where to Be a Woman is the podcast celebrating the best of women's well-being. I'm Sophia Smith-Gaylor.
And I'm Saatchi Kaul.
And we're on a quest to find out where in the world women are living their best lives.
We're hearing from some incredible women about what their countries are getting right.
And picking the best bits for our female fantasy land. Because you can't build it if you can't imagine it first. Where to Be a Woman from the BBC World Service.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Shortly before we started recording this, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres made a speech at the border between Egypt and the Gaza Strip.
Here from this crossing, we see the heartbreak and heartlessness of it all. A long line of blocked red relief trucks on one side of the gates, the long shadow of starvation on the other. That is more than tragic. It is a moral outrage. Any further onslaught will make things even worse. Worse for Palestinian civilians, worse for the hostages, and worse for all people of the region. All this demonstrates that it is more than time for an immediate ceasefire. I say it again. It is time for an ironclad commitment by Israel for total and fettered access for humanitarian goods throughout Gaza. And in the Ramadan spirit of compassion, it is also time for the immediate release of all hostages.
It's not just food the civilian population of the Gaza Strip is in dire need of. Medical assistance is also urgently needed, with hospitals running out of supplies or ceasing to function altogether. And now the first British field hospital has been set up there and is aiming to be fully functioning early next week. As our senior international correspondent Orla Guerin reports, the staff there are busy even before the hospital is fully open.
We'll have 12, at least 12 patients in each of these rooms, and there are three rooms.
CEO David Whittick says they're working around the clock. When their trucks got held up at the border, they got started with local timber from destroyed buildings.
It took a lot of negotiation to get land. It took a lot of negotiation to get things across the border. It's been a challenge to find staff. It's been a challenge to communicate. None of the phones work. None of the internet works. And everything somehow has to be made to work in order to bring essential, urgent, life-saving services to people.
They are already seeing about 100 outpatients a day at the field hospital and expect to double that soon. Doctors are ready to treat everything from minor illnesses to gunshot wounds. A surgical team from the aid group has already been working in the chaos of Al-Aqsa, one of Gaza's main hospitals. Many Palestinians seeking shelter bed down on the floor. It's hard to get a trolley through. But a 12-year-old boy called Anas is on his way to surgery. He has a broken leg and wounds to his face.
We got a patient with a femoral fracture. He's a very brave boy, so let's go.
Anas says he was playing when his neighbourhood was bombed. He was injured and his mother and six-month-old baby brother were killed. May God have mercy on their souls, he says. Anas's surgery goes well. He will recover. But the team have seen some of the worst that war can do.
My name's Judith Kendall. I'm an anaesthetist. I've worked in many war zones over the past 9 years, and I think what shocks me about this is the number of children injured that we are seeing and the extent of those injuries. They are life-changing injuries that the child will have to live with.
Back at the building site, they know the need is immense, with Gaza's hospitals overwhelmed and sometimes under Israeli attack. And if there is a ground invasion of Rafah, as Israel is threatening, the British field hospital could be crucial.
Orla Guerin reporting. Now, if you were to count people, it does help if they are standing still rather than milling around. But if you were to count an entire country, what do you do then? Bolivia is conducting a national census this weekend, and to do this, it is asking all its citizens to stay put. In fact, they have to remain at home. They're not allowed to travel. They're not even supposed to drink alcohol. Paul Moss spoke to our Americas regional editor, Leonardo Rocha.
It's basically a curfew that goes on from Friday night until Sunday morning. And you have 900,000 volunteers canvassing people across the country, a long questionnaire with many questions. And those who are counted or fill in the forms, even after that, they'll have to stay at home. They can't meet at any clubs. They can't go to the streets. And that's the way they do it in Bolivia. I don't know any other country that does it that way. Some more remote locations will be done on Monday and Tuesday. They have about 3 days to do it. But say all shops are closed, flights are suspended.
Bolivia is a very spread out, mountainous country. I mean, do they really think that people in small villages at high altitude, they're all obeying the rules and staying in, waiting for the census person to come and take their details?
Well, that's interesting because it's crucial for them to know where people come from, if they're migrants or not. So I think, for example, if a person couldn't go to their home, they have ways of finding that out. But you have to try to be as honest as possible, because what we have here is the whole political and economic implication of that. The census is used to determine the allocation from federal government, federal resources, and also the number of seats in Congress to the nine different regions. And you have people in the highlands, in the main city, La Paz, where basically the support, the left-wing support for the government is. And you have people in the eastern province of Santa Cruz, which is the wealthiest province of Bolivia, that has experienced an exponential growth of population, internal migrants. So the whole controversy that we have is that this census should have been held 2 years ago, but the opposition on the east side of the country said we should hold it as close to the election as possible to reflect internal migration. And the government refused to do that. Finally, they came to the agreement of doing it now.
Do Bolivians mostly accept that this is just an unpleasant necessity that for doing a census, or is it an unpopular thing that they have to do?
I think what amazes everyone is the compliance. I mean, I think Bolivians, that's the way they do it. They accept it. And the last time we had a census, only 300 people were arrested for breaking the curfew in a population of 12 million people. That's not many.
That was Leonardo Rocha. Lil Nas X is only 24 years old, but he's already one of America's most acclaimed and at times controversial rappers. A full-length documentary about him is now being shown at FLAIR, the British Film Institute's annual festival of gay cinema from around the world. It's the European premiere of the movie called Long Live Montero, a nod to the rapper's real name. Vincent Dowd went to meet the men who made the film.
One, two, three, four. Need a boy who can cuddle with me all night. Give me one, let me long, be my sunlight. Tell me
the former Montero Hill, born in Georgia, has become a star worldwide as rapper and songwriter Lil Nas X. He has millions of followers online. He came out as gay when he was 20. The film the BFI have premiered in London is in part a record of Lil Nas X's huge energy on stage, but its makers say it's much else besides.
My name is Carlos Lopez Estrada. I am one of the two directors of Lil Nas X, Long Live Montero. We knew that we were going to capture a coming of age of sorts, so we were just there to see how an artist goes from being sort of like an intimate bedroom artist to being this sort of like very, very public performer. That's the intention of the doc, to capture that magic, that moment.
Some people think my music is dope. Some people see me as like this satanic devil.
When I was a kid, my sexuality was just like the elephant in the room.
The co-director is Zach Manuel. He shot some of the extravagantly produced concerts, as much theater as music event.
I think his audience is anyone who struggled with their identity or had struggles with expressing themselves as honestly and as truthfully as they want to. His audience is black queerness in the American South. And there's like an entire legacy of black queer artists from the South that at different times in history have been like washed over or have been like pushed back into the closet. It gives people kind of someone to look to say, my story matters. This is my truth as well.
Videos viewed online by the million have been crucial to his success, expensively made and often full of gay imagery. But the most recent, Jay Christ, was too much for some Americans who identified what they regarded as religious mockery and the sexualization of the sacred. Lil Nas X posted online an apology of sorts.
I knew like there would be some upset people or whatnot. You know, religion is a very sensitive topic for a lot of people. It was literally me saying, oh, I'm back like Jesus. Like, that was like the whole thing. I'm not the first person to dress up as Jesus, and I won't be the last.
Long Live Montero is an insight into a performer whose music and mastery of social media promise a long career. But filmmaker Carlos Lopez Estrada says Lil Nas X's fans see him as more than just a music star.
because of his story, because he's a queer black man in a world that still isn't fully open to acknowledging the existence of queer black men, he's really taking this responsibility to be as open and as vulnerable and as honest as he can about his identity, about his struggles. And I think he just became this icon of radical vulnerability, radical honesty, but I feel like he matters in a very profound way to a lot of people.
The filmmaker Carlos Lopez Estrada ending that report by Vincent Dowd. Let's return to our top story now. Friday's attack by gunmen on a concert hall in Moscow, which has left at least 115 people dead. The Islamic State group has admitted being behind the assault. Mina Al-Lami is BBC Monitoring's jihadism specialist. So what exactly have IS said?
This was a very brief and generic claim that was issued by the group's so-called news agency, Amaq. So this is official. This is an official news outlet of IS. And they simply said that soldiers of the caliphate, without saying how many, soldiers of Islamic State carried out this attack, targeting crowds of Christians, as IS said. And it said the attackers then fled the scene unharmed and withdrew. What we are expecting now is a follow-up statement from IS to give details and to explain which of its global branches was responsible for this attack. And this is kind of the norm in terms of its media operation. Usually there's an initial claim from Amaq, and then there is a follow-up claim with details from IS. So we're still waiting for those details. And I think everyone around the world is asking which of these branches. Is it the ISKP, the Khorasan branch that is focused on Afghanistan, or is it actually IS has or claims to have a branch in Russia or in that region called the Caucasus branch? Is it that branch that carried out the attack? So we're still waiting for those details.
Indeed. But Mina, why would any of these branches want to attack Russia?
Russia, historically, in terms of jihadists, it's kind of up there with the US as the main enemy of the jihadists and others. They consider all of these countries, to be honest, they consider them infidel countries, key targets. So in terms of the strategy, I guess Russia doesn't make sense right now in terms of what's happening in the world. Why would IS want to attack Russia specifically now? I think personally, it's more of an opportunity. They happen to currently have operatives in Russia who are capable and who are willing. We know that the Russian authorities killed a number of suspected IS affiliates earlier this month in Ingushetia. And so the group has carried out attacks in the past in mainland Russia, very small attacks, as well as in Russian republics. The way, at least for now, it was presented last night, the claim, simply that the target were Christians. But we will have to wait for the full IS claim with details, in which the group will explain why it carried out this attack. It could be in response to calls earlier this year by the leadership for branches all over the world to step up their attacks.
The BBC's jihadism expert, Mina Al-Lami. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Pat Sissons. The producers were Nikki Verico and Alfie Habershon. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.